I'm Jen Salata, and I was a writer on The Office.
Hello, everyone. Welcome, one and all, to the latest and, for this week, greatest installment of The Office Deep Dive. I am your host, Brian Baumgartner. Today, you will be experiencing my conversation with Jen Salata. Now, Jen joined our show as a writer in season two. And if you listen to my conversation with Mike Schur, you know that Mike describes Jen as the beating heart of the show. I had never thought of it that way, but I realized after he said it that that is so true. And you can totally see Jen's influence on the show starting in that second season. Jen wrote some of the most complex, subtle, psychological storylines that we ever had. And it was so fun for me to talk about that with her. Jen is also crazy smart and absolutely hilarious. And she has the most infectious laugh, which you will hear lots of momentarily. But most importantly, she was the only guest who brought me cookies when she came in to talk. That's right. She brought me cookies. So that officially makes Jen my favorite guest of all time. So, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome my friend and soon to be yours, Jen Salata.
Bubble and squeak, I love it. Bubble and squeak, I know. Bubble and squeak, I cook it every morning, left over from the night before.
Awesome.
Well, the thing with dudes is you get to look better when you get older. Girls, we don't.
Is that true?
Yeah.
Really?
It's a problem.
Oh, there you go.
There's right, like some there. Distinguished silver fox gray that happens. Oh. It's like girls don't, you know.
Why
have
can't
the same thing?
Why can't girls have that?
I don't know. I'll try it out.
So, you know what happens. Just a little side gray.
You just look good. It you does just look start, so young. You oh, look. You look young.
My God.
You look so good. You do. Truth. I speak truth.
God, why don't we hang out more?
I don't know.
Why is this happening?
And I think that every time we hang out, there should be microphones now.
Should there?
Yeah. Just, yeah. We should always and record everything.
And no lavs, just big, yes, just big mics.
That's amazing.
I just spent some time with Ed Helms.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Oh, my
he
God.
He ran out of here to make sure he didn't see you.
Seriously? What the fuck is that about? You know what's amazing? I was going to maybe tell a sort of embarrassing story that doesn't make him look bad, that makes me totally embarrassed about it, that
no,
I've never
go.
Told on anything.
Okay, go.
It's totally embarrassing, though. You ready?
Yes.
Okay. This is embarrassing. Why am I starting with this? But no. That you just mentioned his name is so funny. So I can't remember what season this was, but you'll know from what I'm talking about. I had an idea where Ed was going to sing Take a Chance on Me.
Okay.
And I remember I told Greg that idea, and he's like, go down and tell Ed, you know, talk to him about it, you know, about the song, because he'll be singing it soon.
All right.
And I just remember, like, being a fan of Ed's from The Daily Show. He was an attractive, interesting, cool, dorky, you know, banjo-playing dude. So,
right.
Like, there was a part of me that was like, oh, this is a cool dude. And I guess so I got a little kind of nervous about, you know, like, I don't know, just a tiny bit nervous around him at first, you know, professional,
right.
But just like a little bit nervous. So I go over and I knock on his trailer door because I have to ask him, you know, do you know this song? And let's talk about the song or whatever. I'm assuming he knows it. He knows music. He's Mr. Music, right? Knock on his door. He's like, hey, Jen. I was like, hi. So I had this idea for an episode coming up soon, probably next week. I don't remember. This is me remembering exactly when. And I said, it's Take a Chance on Me. And I said, you know that song? He's like, what? And I was like, you know that song? He did not know the song. So I had to sing Take a Chance on Me, duet. We like were on the parking lot of the office.
So you were like, take a chance on
your mind. And I can't sing. Also, I can't sing and I'm singing to a singer. Anyway, he was lovely. It was all fine. But it was one of the dorky moments of my life.
That's so funny.
I never told him that because it's just awkward because I didn't want to be like, I'm nervous around you, but now I'll tell the world.
There it is. I will make sure he hears
yes,
that story.
That's cool.
All right. So you came to the office in season two, which basically yes. was when Lee and Jean joined too.
Yes.
Yes.
You were the new kids.
You were the new kids. How was that, by the way, coming into that room?
It was great. It was intimidating. I'd been on a bunch of other writing staffs. I'd been writing for a while, but I was a huge fan of the show. I was a huge fan of the British Office. And then I was on Malcolm in the Middle and watching the American Office, and I'd watch the Office when it aired. And the next morning, all I'd talk about at work was the Office, which was delightful for the, for the Malcolm people while I was trying to write Malcolm. So I was just very intimidated at first, but excited. I felt like there were a lot of shows that I worked on that there were a few shows that were my sensibility. I got to work on Andy Richter Controls the Universe and got to work on some other, you know, interesting, cool shows. But this show was the first show where I was like, oh, God, like the humor and the heart, everything about it, I just felt like so connected to, and also just kind of drier, subtle humor, dry humor, subtle humor. There were so many things that were appealing to me about it. So I both was incredibly excited and also like, don't fuck this up. Can we say fuck, by the way?
Yeah, we can say whatever we want. So let me rewind a little bit.
Yes.
So you're on Malcolm in the Middle.
Yes.
And then what happens? You get a meeting with Greg?
I get a meeting with Greg. I was on a development deal actually also with NBC. So I left Malcolm in the Middle. Full disclosure, did not get asked back to Malcolm in the Middle. That'll come back. Maybe because I'm just talking about The Office all the time. They were like, what the hell? But yeah, so I left. I had a meeting with Greg. I met him at a Coffee Bean somewhere. Just desperately wanted to be on the show. Had a fantastic meeting. Loved him instantly. There was a very pregnant pause in my interview with him of just, it felt like it was like 5 minutes long, but I'm not quite sure. It was just him sort of kind of putting his hand on his forehead and looking down. And I'm like, I don't know if this is, I have no idea which way this is going. Cause like, I think it was going well, but I don't really know. And there was a long pause. And then he was like, hey, so do you want to join the staff?
In the moment, you sold
by
yourself.
I think a lot of it, probably to Greg's later dismay, is that when he was silent for a little while, just trying to process or think about things or who knows what, I didn't speak. Then, surprise, surprise, I wouldn't shut up once he hired me.
Right.
And I could tell you a funny story about that as well.
But yeah.
I felt so aligned with The Office before, just even as a fan. And I know there were some changes and we did some tweaking to things going into season two, which made it even more maybe in my wheelhouse of kind of heart and, you know, rooting for Carell and kind of finding the underbelly of his character and stuff like that. But season one, I was just a huge fan. So.
Right. So wait. Yes. Well, so many things.
Yes,
first
sorry.
Of all, so what I've been told was that Greg, in consultation with the network and blah, 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 he needed to soften Steve for season two, that Kevin Reilly was very happy with what had happened, but that people watching it was actually something that you want in television. And so Greg came in. It will be interesting to hear your perspective on this because you weren't a writer before, but that Greg was the one who pushed for Steve being softened, and that there was everyone else who was in the room and a writer at the time felt like, no, you're going to kill the show.
Oh, that's fascinating. I do have thoughts on it, even though I wasn't there. Because I think that depending on how you interpret soften, it could sound like something that could be very threatening to the show. And it could, for me, because I know what it ended up being, I'll explain why I think it was a great decision. But I remember we were early on in season two talking about how do we do this? And a lot of people had great ideas. I just remember specifically, I had talked to my dad, who's a physicist. I come from a very kind of nerdy, adore them family, a physicist and a psychologist and a mechanical engineer is my brother. And my dad was in had a high level position where he ended up having to fire people. And I remember him telling me about firing people from the point of view of a boss, that it's like you always are thinking about the person who gets fired because that's the person you're sympathizing with, right? Of course, you're going to tell a story. You would sympathize with the person who's being fired. But I remember my dad saying it's very kind of lonely, weird thing, you know, and you're having to make a decision that's affecting another person, and it's really difficult. And sort of the extension of that with having Michael Scott, who just like, you guys are his family, and if he has to get rid of one of you, it's devastating, was just sort of an interesting way to see things that affect him, but to understand and feel for him. Do you know what I mean? I think it's the feeling for him and seeing the underbelly and seeing the why of what he's doing, as opposed to what I think was a very common network note often, which is make someone more likable. And I think that if you take that for what it sounds like, just make somebody more likable, it feels like you're taking all the character and everything away and you're just softening them into this benign mush of a human, which would, like, imagine Carell having to play somebody just, you know, that couldn't have any edges, that couldn't do outrageously, ridiculously bad things.
Right. Well, and I think what Greg ultimately said was that for 95% of the episode, it would play the same way, that he could still do this behavior.
Yes.
He could still be an idiot. He could still be insensitive, but then just find just a moment.
Tiny moment.
At the end where you see this other side of him. And actually, you talked about firing someone, and there's the Halloween episode.
Oh, yes.
And again, that last moment, you just see him giving out the candy to the kids.
It just humanizes him in a way where you understand, like, there's a kind of a man who's alone and he's giving out candy and he's got this sweet part of him. Yeah, I agree. I can understand. We had more arguments in that room than almost any other room I've ever been in. And they were like, I always say it was like a healthy marriage where you're supposed to fight. They're supposed to be fighting. It's safe and we love each other, but we would fight. And I just think it's because we all gave a shit. It's like we really, really cared. I've been in rooms where everybody just sits there and kind of, you know, waits till it's time to go home more. And this was not that. Everybody cared desperately about everything.
Yeah. Do you think being a woman, and only you and Mindy were women at the time, writers, do you feel like, well, first of all, how was that for you?
You know, I always feel like in this, I'm supposed to be saying more than I do, or I'm reevaluating how I felt all the time, but I didn't think about it. Like, I don't know. I'll talk about The Office specifically in a second, but I've been so incredibly fortunate in my career to work with incredibly evolved men. And I feel like, yes, I always wish there were more women and more diversity in every staff. Always. That is always something that I wanted and wished for and asked for. But I didn't feel uncomfortable in any way. I just felt very blessed and lucky. Again, it's on me. It's certainly in the later days to try to incorporate and bring in other people and make rooms more diverse. But I didn't have that feeling. And certainly when I got there, Mindy was there. And so I felt like, and there were maybe, I don't remember now, six of us, seven of us. And, you know, so there were two women out of seven. And I knew she was incredibly talented and just loved working with her. But no, I didn't. I had a, I feel like it should have occurred to me more than it did, and it didn't. So that's how I feel, a responsibility to other ladies, you know, to just sort of go back and, you know, think of things. So I certainly have had female friends that have had more, you know, because I was the only woman on maybe three staffs that I've been on.
Okay.
And even in those situations, again, yes, I would always like to have the more voices in the room, and the more diverse the voices are in the room, the better the show is. It just is. So it always should be that way. But on the shows when I was coming up, the guys that I worked with were fantastic, and I didn't feel uncomfortable.
Yeah. So Greg has talked about, or this quote was attributed to him or something like it. Mike Schur said that Greg talked about wanting to create a writer's room that was like the X-Men, right? So that not everybody had a special skill that was the same. So what I have been told is, and let's see if you agree with
okay,
this.
Okay, I love this.
That Lee and Gene were very good at the cringe comedy.
Yeah. Oh, God, excellent.
That Mike was more optimistic. That Mindy was more absurdist, but also tied into some of the love stuff.
Yeah.
Paul was very into Michael's worst instincts. and then you, I was told, one, you were very into Pam and sort of the beating heart of the show. Hmm. And then Greg wasn't sure about that. He said you were very interested in Michael's stories and finding the complexity there. What's funny is that the episode that was referenced for both of those two things from Mike Schur and from Greg was the same episode where the bird dies.
Oh, yeah.
Whereas Greg saw that as being about Michael and him having to find a way to deal with it. Mm-hmm. And Mike saw that as about Pam and Pam making the decision to facilitate the funeral for Michael.
Oh, so my gosh.
Interesting that they referenced the same episode but came up with two different responses. Do you feel like what was your superpower or what interested you?
What's amazing, that is fascinating. And I can see how they both could say that. What's interesting to me is that for me, it's understanding the humanity of a person and the levels of a person and the psychology of a person. To me, it was very much Michael that, you know, it was not the Pam element in that. I love Pam and Michael's connection. I love their relationship. But for me, it was steering Michael through that sort of the stages of grief. I never got to write internal stories where something kind of was happening to the insides of a character. And I was like, this is a story on a network television show that is an internal story where the character that it's happening to is not even aware of it. So like, I was like, my brain was exploding. So I kind of feel like they're both right in a way where it's like, but with that particular episode, it was Michael. I had this moment with Steve when I was leaving the show and I told him it was very, very difficult decision. It was the best job I ever had by far, but I was starting to feel like I wanted to write some of my own stuff. And I told Greg and then I told Steve and, you know, I'm sad. I'm really upset. I mean, it was like the best opportunity of my life. And he said, I think this is going to be difficult for you. I said, oh, yeah. You know why? I could tell somebody was saying something else. And he said, because I think you work out a lot of your own stuff through my character. Oh, my God. Michael Scott thinks I'm Michael Scott.
Oh, my gosh.
I mean, he meant it. He didn't mean it as a bad thing, but he was just earnest and genuine in it. And like, I was like, why can't I be Pam? Why can't I be Angela? Why can't I be Phyllis? Why can't I be, like, I'll be Dwight. No, but I mean, I adore Michael Scott. And he's not wrong. There are moments in my life. I'm very intrigued with his character, but there are also moments in my life where I feel Michael Scotty, and I think everyone does, but I thought that was unbelievable.
Oh my gosh. That is so amazing.
And there's a sweetness to it because I've told some people that and they're like, oh, but Michael, you love Michael and you know he's connected and he loves. But like I immediately went to the most ridiculous sides of Michael. Like there was a moment after it where I thought of him where I had to type up an email that I was going to have to send as soon as I got home. I was, oh, God, this is terrible to say. I was on the side. I was at a stoplight, and I had my computer open. And I was, like, typing, because if I finished typing it the second I got home, I was going to send it. And I just imagined, like, a cop pulling me over with my laptop. I'm in the driver's. I'm driving, and I've got my laptop open, and he's like, ma'am, you know. And I'm like, I'm not texting. I'm emailing. So there are definitely moments where I'm like, I think maybe I am, but anyway.
Oh, that's so amazing.
That took me on a long journey there to that. But yeah, but I'm fascinated with what makes people tick and the layers underneath people. And I feel like writing for me is about connecting. I think there's so many things that people think are just themselves. And when you see it on screen, you feel like kind of comforted. Again, maybe that's just me.
No.
Maybe that's the Michael Scott in me. You're just comforted that other people are like that too. So the stuff inside that you don't get to see is what I like to try to bring out or show, even if they're not saying it's happening.
There's something that came up in talking with Greg that I did not know. It was very clear. Greg wanted a collaboration, and he wanted the lines between the writers and the actors to be blurred, and he wanted it to be much more collaborative. Mm-hmm. I was aware that was happening, and I was aware that it felt very different than any other show. But I think for me, it was always about, really about the writers, that it was about the writers were acting, and the writers had sort of an unfettered access to set. Greg told me that his idea was not that. His idea was to blur the lines between the writers and the actors because he felt that in this new genre, the laughs were about behavior. Mm. That there was something for him that he needed the actors, for the writers to see the actors, because behavior was way more important in this kind of a show than in traditional television.
Oh, that's fascinating. I agree with that. I don't think I ever sort of felt it as that was what was happening, like kind of what you're saying. But I do think that anytime you try to, part of me just thinks that blurring the lines just makes it a happier environment, because it always felt like the writers were on the shows I worked on, the writers were off and then the actors were off and there was absolutely no crossover and you didn't feel like you were part of a family together with each other. Like there were shows where I didn't even go down to the set. You know, you never saw the show, you know, you never saw the actors act. And I just think it's always better if you kind of mush the two together. I think that it's kind of starting to create a character and then working with the actor to see what they do with it and how they make it theirs, that kind of thing, I feel like. And then when you have a specific story about a specific character, going down and kind of getting to know them enough so that you can infuse it so much with the goodness and the specificity of you guys is such a big thing. I guess I never really thought of it exactly that way, what he's saying, but I do think that if you think about the show being really needing to be real, like I'm imagining the worst case of what would have happened if what Greg was saying wasn't true, is that writers would be in a room coming up with these witty one-liners that were not based at all in what a human being would do and a specific human being. So that if you go down and to the set, down, whatever, we're a couple of stories up, but like, and then work with them and more, listen to them and see how they would get from point A to point B in a realistic way. It'll feel more real and more rich than if you're just like, haha, this is a funny joke. You know, like the worst kind of writing where you're like, here's a funny joke and we'll just give this joke to somebody, you know, without really taking into consideration. But I don't know.
Right.
Unpacking live.
Right. Why was writing the character so real, so important?
For me, because it was a mockumentary, I found that a lot of discussions we'd have were about comedy versus reality. So we had these discussions a lot. I think we had them even camera-wise. We also had a lot of moments. We were talking about Michael and Jan. Unbelievable relationship. So funny. When once we got to the point where he seemed like he was almost devolving past her, that moment, we had so many fights in the room because and the fight seemed to be comedy versus mockumentary, right, but like reality versus comedy. It felt to me like if we were doing a mockumentary, a documentary, if we're leaning into that, we would want this character of Michael Scott to keep growing. If we're just thinking with our comedy glasses on, Jan and Michael are hilarious, right? So there's this tension of should we keep him stuck in this relationship because we can mine it for ridiculous humor, or should we evolve him? So I always lean to this point of evolving. I just start as a viewer with that particular show, disconnecting a little if I feel that somebody is stuck in a thing that would not be stuck in real life. Do you know what I mean? And I think the audience feels that too. They feel like they're being jerked around. And then I think you have it more with Michael and with the Jim and Pam. We had those discussions most with those characters. Everybody we wanted to evolve or see different shades of, or have them go through journey. Sometimes they'd go forward, sometimes they'd go backwards, but we'd want to see some amount of movement. But specifically, the biggest fights were between Michael's evolution, because it was so central to what we were seeing, and also with Jim and Pam. So I remember those fights. I remember being like, oh, no, we need to, at some point, we can't break. It felt fake to break Jim and Pam up. Once it was those characters set up by Greg and the early writers and then acted by John and Jenna in such a ridiculously beautiful way. I didn't believe that the threats that we were talking about that could come in to keep them apart so that we could kind of have more of that juice. It just didn't.
Yeah. So I've talked to a few people about this, just about comedy too. And I had this director that I worked with and he was obsessed with the notion that comedy exists off of the beat. But Greg said something that you were just talking about, which is kind of the same idea, actually. You guys both said it in different ways, but about Pam and Jim, that there becomes an inevitability. Mm. And so what Greg said was the choice ultimately was get them together actually sooner than anyone thinks, right? So suddenly, like it happens sort of in an instant so fast. On one second, you think he's going to be the manager at another branch.
Right, right.
And then 1 second later, it's, do you want to go on a date? And then they're off and rolling.
That's so pure, Greg. He's such a genius. And what I love is he did that multiple times. We would come up with an idea or something and he would advance it to have that surprise factor. And what I loved about him was that he had the confidence and the skills, clearly, obviously, to take that risk of doing something earlier than what was expected and knowing that we would be able to deal with the fallout of like, oh, shit, they're together, you know? And I can't quite remember. I just can't remember. There was a season that we ended on a cliffhanger. We wrote ourselves a little bit into a corner and then we're just like, I don't know. Like, and then it's like, well, guess what? We have 8 weeks after this to figure it out. But I love that because it's daring and it's brave and it's not like waiting till the last second and waiting till it all has it planned out. So there's like a thrill in terms of being a writer and story when you have Jim and Pam get together before you think, then you have to deal with all the repercussions of that quicker. And it's scary, but there's a thrill about that. That's exciting.
Right. I'm going to go back for a second because you were so articulate in your idea of truth and comedy that no one has explained to me before. I know that there was a discussion about this and way, way less significant than, you know, how long Michael should stay with Jan or the Jim and Pam thing. But when Dwight plays a prank on Holly and tells her that Kevin is slow – and everyone was like, we got to keep this going. We got to keep this going. But that, actually, you sort of sang that.
I have a backstory for that joke, too. That was my joke.
Oh, go ahead. Joke,
which I think you'll find, you'll appreciate.
Well, just my point was that at a certain point, in terms of truth versus comedy, like, at what point does it become unbelievable that Holly doesn't really know the truth?
Right.
So that just occurred to me as you were talking, like, I get that now.
Yeah, that you're trying to find
it ended different... pretty quickly.
Yeah.
But it's because
there's a reality and a believability and the audience feels it. I feel like it's not always that they know exactly what it is, but I feel like there are certain things about that show particular that if you went in a different direction, it can distance the audience. I mean, one of the classic things is that, you know, if hair starts looking too good and makeup and wardrobe and the lights look too beautiful, it's like you're starting to feel a distance between these people. So I feel like there was a reality that you wanted to keep. I was just thinking about that joke. The backstory to that, there was a point in the show where I think it was coming from like Greg just feeling like, you know, we were probably doing 28 episodes a season, but it was like, we're getting lazy. We know this about this character. We know this about this character. What else do we know about this character? So we did it for many, many of the characters. I think all of them probably. But I specifically remember, we were like, what do we know about Kevin? We know that he likes to snack. We know that he's maybe not the brightest accountant that we have, right? So it's like, if we're lazy, we go to these things too often, right? So, you know, in the Venn diagram of all the things we know about Kevin or whatever, what are some more things? Like, does he like opera? Would that make sense with what we know about Kevin? I mean, literally, we did this for multiple characters, but this was the moment that I remember being in there right when I was about to go off and write a script. And so I went off and my interpretation of that was just to take one of those two things to blow it up. Like, I did definitely try to reach deeper because he was saying, like, go bigger, go deeper, find more. So now I took it all the way to the point where it was like, yeah, Kevin is, like, you know, mentally slow and there's a real issue here. And that's Holly's interpretation of it. And when I did it, I think I did it as a joke. It definitely was one joke in the script, and it might have been two. And then I brought it back to the room, and they're like, no, 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 we're doing more. more. So we expanded it, but I was a little bit delighted slash embarrassed about the fact that my goal was to find something different. I just doubled down on maybe not the bright.
Well, yeah. I don't know. It always made me laugh. Was there anything else that was specific or unique that you remember about this writing room? Writer's room?
It was the best writer's room I've ever been in. And I feel like it will be the best writer's room I'm ever in. I think the writers were exceptionally talented. And Greg was saying that everybody had their own super strengths, but everybody was good at story and comedy and emotion. I felt that certain people, were more gifted in certain areas, but I've worked on staffs where one person was story, one person was comedy. There is a little bit more like that. And I felt like this staff, everybody had the ability to do everything. And the fact that everybody cared so much, there was an enormous discussion, I don't know if anybody talked about it, between whether the proposal should have sound or no sound. There were people on both sides. It was about 50-50. It was the craziest discussion. It was whether or not when we saw Jim propose to Pam, we should have sound and hear what he's saying or just see the visual of him in the rain getting on one knee. And I found that that really explained the writer's room. Everybody cared so much. There was one moment where Greg was getting into his car, you know, after the discussion had gone on for a month and we were about to, you know, have to settle on it, where I was coming from a trailer and he was getting into his car and I said, Greg, and he like turned and he was like kind of trapped between his car door and his car. And I was like, did you decide yet if it was sound or no sound? And he's like, no, I haven't. It was literally like a horror film. Like I was stalking him to find out if the decision had been made. We argued passionately, and it was just because everybody cared. And I think that a lot of it was just the passion with which – the passion everybody had for telling the story. I can talk a little bit about the sound, no sound, if you want to hear it, but you might hear it from everybody else, too.
No, go ahead.
So that was actually a decision a little bit that I feel like came down to another discussion that we had a lot of times in the room, which was – kind of being more documentary and a little bit more real and a little bit more subtle and being a little bit more like a comedy or a show. So basically, the side that wanted to hear Jim's words were like, you've been waiting forever to hear him propose to Pam. Why would you take that moment away from people and not hear his actual words? It's like they've been waiting for it. You want to give them what they've been waiting for, which might be slightly more of a comedy show kind of thing. With a mockumentary thing, it was a little bit more of like, God, it's so beautiful and subtle, and to be across the street and to have to reach for it because he would turn his mic off in this moment. It's a big moment. And once you see him down on one knee, we know what he's saying. And then actually filling in the blank is more beautiful. We went back and forth about this for so long. At one point, Greg asked me to send in my pros and cons list of like sound and no sound. And then I remember I was in his office a little bit later. Still hadn't made a decision. And I saw a list of people who wanted sound and a list of people who wanted no sound. And his wife and two kids was on one side of the list and two other kids, or his wife and one kid was on one side of the list and two other kids. His family was split down the middle. So he was interviewing everybody and saying, what should we do? What should we do? So there was a moment, he was at the sound mix. He had to make the decision. Like, this is the moment. And he's like, is there anybody we haven't asked? And I said, oh yeah, the security guard is there. You know, security guard whose name I can't quite remember. I'm sorry. But I go and I get the security guard, and it occurs to me during my walk to the office that he's never seen the office. Lovely, lovely man, protected us all, right. Not an office fan.
Right.
So I'm like, okay, cool. So now we've just got a very objective person. So I show him the scene without sound, and then I show him the scene with sound, and I say, what did you prefer? And he said, I liked the second one. And I said, why? And he said, oh, because I could hear it. Okay, Greg. He said he liked the second second one because he could hear it. So that was it. Anyway, that wasn't how the decision was made, but that was our last person weighing in. And then, you know, it ended up airing with sound. But it was the debate about whether or not it should be sound or no sound was the writer's room to me. It was everybody incredibly passionate about something that we had worked towards. And just we really cared.
Well, it's fascinating to me. When Steve left and Pam goes to say goodbye, there's no sound.
Mm. You know what's weird? I saw it. I loved it. I just got chills when you even just described it because it's such a beautiful moment. And I don't know if it speaks to there's a secret dynamic between Pam and Michael that we just can't be privy to. I don't know, but it's a similar kind of moment, right? I mean, it's like, maybe, do you think it's possible that because the other one involved Jim and Pam and there were so many people like rooting for that relationship and kind of squeeing or whatever about them that you couldn't take that moment away from them? But for Pam and Michael, who have an incredibly special dynamic too, it's not a like romantic thing. So it's not like fans have been shipping them for 4 years and we can do that. I don't know. I really don't know because I don't.
No, but it's interesting because what you say is how people fill it in that moment when Michael leaves. You can't write it. It's written with Pam telling you what was said, but did she include every detail?
Right.
And what she says is beautiful, but you don't, I don't know, it's.
It's so interesting. I like when you, so I on the staff like when you have to fill in the blanks more. I think when in Casino Night, we had another huge fight on staff about, you know, how to portray something, whether to make Jim and Pam in the parking lot more, you know, dirty or not. And I was always, I didn't want to miss everything. I just wanted to be late to the party or find the shadow of them and to hear them talking, to not see it the cleanest, to not be very clean in terms of the presentation. I always wanted to reach because I think reaching and filling the blanks is more. But I was probably on one end of the spectrum in that room with those things.
Well, Greg brought up both of those moments. And I think, and I'm certainly not coming down on one side or the other. I think that I would tend to agree with you that I loved that moment when Michael leaves. I think it's perfect. But it's interesting what Greg said in that moment in the parking lot specifically. He said, these are really skilled actors and you can see a lot in their faces. And so in this moment, we need to see their face.
Oh, that's brilliant. And that makes a lot of sense. Like I understand that. I completely get that. There was an interesting discussion, and it wasn't that came up that I forgot to mention when we were talking about sound, no sound. And I was talking to my dad about offensive and defensive decision making. I mean, we were just digging deep in this sound or no sound. Like, we were digging deep. And what I learned, too, and this is where I know that sometimes I'm on the super kind of weirdo end of the spectrum, is that with offensive, you just do what's your gut instinct and what's your best thing that you think you should do. And you don't worry about anything else, any other factors. With defensive, that I think is an important thing, but I don't pay attention to it enough, is what do the fans want? What will feel satisfying? Will I regret? You just kind of go outside, do you know what I mean? To think about, you think about the audience a little bit more. So in terms of the moment specifically for Jim and Pam, are we thinking, what do we want to do kind of artistically, show-wise, character-wise, or are we thinking, what do people want?
You joined the staff in season two, when the show was still, well, we didn't know how many we were going to do. And so the question really is, what factors do you think helped to make the show from the beginning of season two, getting a 6-episode order, to by the end, completing a full 22-episode season and then immediately getting a third season? Were there any factors that you can point to for what was happening?
I think a lot of it, and I've forgotten sort of the behind the scenes people fighting for it, because I feel like Ben Silverman, a lot of people just fought very hard for things that I wasn't privy to. I was just coming on and trying to, you know, write. But I know that there were a lot of people fighting very hard for the show. I think a couple things. I think one was just re-attacking Carell's character and just giving it more dimensions, just giving it more of a 360-degree feel.
Well, there was another sort of significant thing that happened, which I don't expect you to remember, but iTunes launched.
Yes, yes. So I remember going and getting a computer around that time and seeing the Apple Store just had the office everywhere. So yeah, so iTunes launching, huge. Yeah, so then people could just, you know, download it and watch it. And then it started to feel like people were watching it. Like, I think BJ had this thing. He said that it felt like it was an inside joke with our fans. Like we didn't know that a ton of people were watching it, but we just kept meeting some people who were fans and they were going crazy for it. So I don't know if the numbers were necessarily reflected right away. And I also remember Jenny Tan from Office Tally. And I remember Jenna was like on MySpace talking to fans. So I think the communication with the fans and other ways for people to watch the show. And I also think deleted scenes started really helping us too, is that people were getting bonus material and they were really excited about that. And I don't know when quite that was, if that was a little bit later or.
Yeah, it's this whole sort of wave of technology that was kismet for the show, that people have been able to use the new technology that existed in the moment sort of at the perfect time for The Office.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I remember us going on Office Tally at the end of every episode to see, like, what the fans thought. It was just really, like, live-time kind of, like, reviews of the show by the people who watched it. And it was just fascinating.
How much did that influence the writers?
We definitely felt it. I don't think, but you should ask other people because I don't remember. I don't remember it ever affecting any, like, storylines or changes. But I think that it was a barometer for certain things. You know, if we were slowing down Pam and Jim and everyone was like, I like the fact that it's slow. We wouldn't, you know, like we might not feel the pressure of it as much. So I feel like there were little things like that, but it was never like, oh, they want this, so we have to give it to them. Do you know what I mean? But
right. There
was a moment, and you have to confirm this. We would have little debates in the room. And then I remember we would read the fans, and every once in a while the fans would comment on something that we, you know, like, should we do proposal sound or no sound? And then fans would say, like, you know, someone would be like, I wish there was no sound, or which would be weird because, like, how would they even know? But there was one little debate, and I cannot remember what it was, but it was small. It was a small debate, but it was passionate, as most things. And I think that Lee was on one side of the debate, and I was on the other side of the debate. And after the episode aired, somebody on Office Tally said something that was just, you know, totally agreeing with, like, how Lee felt and not agreeing at all with what I felt. And I was like, huh, it's a bummer, whatever. A few weeks or months later, I found out that Lee was that person. He wrote into Office Tally under a fake name, just writing it.
This was like the original burner accounts existed in the Office writer's room.
You should confirm this with Lee, but I'm 99% sure he did it. I think he was just doing it to give me shit because, like, he disagreed with me and he's like, look, even the fans disagree with you. I was like, wait, what the fuck? This is not cool. I really thought people liked the drug testing episode. Did anyone like it, or are these just you guys? So I was like, is anybody here not in the writer's room that I'm reading?
That is amazing. I was aware. Yeah. I mean, as an actor, I typically chose to not read it.
Yeah.
Because it's just not, it's just not helpful.
Yeah.
And two, it's the old thing where 50 people say nice things about you, and then we got that.
Yeah.
Then it's like,
I don't know if it's my comedy writerness or my Jewishness, although, like, I don't know what it is, but yeah, if 80 people say something nice and one person's something wrong, it's like, what is that? Why did they say that? That must be true. I don't remember. I immediately forget all the other ones.
Yeah. By the way, our conversation today, which I think is going really, really well. See, I realized I can take a pause here, people in the booth, and nobody will ever know
that I took a little pause.
They'll
cut that shit out.
Yeah. I like keeping our conversation
going. I can tell you a story about someone who didn't like The Office that I had this funny exchange with.
Yes, go ahead. Please, go ahead.
I was on a plane early on, season 3 or 4, had a Dunder Mifflin sweatshirt. I was getting off the plane where the pilot was saying, thank you for flying. And he was an older man, saw my Dunder Mifflin sweatshirt. He's like, what is that? And I saw Dunder Mifflin. I was like, oh, it's Dunder Mifflin. He's like, I know what that is. It's The Office. And I like something in his tone. I like didn't be like, yeah, I'm working on it. It's my favorite show ever. I love it. Yeah. He's like, oh, I don't like that show. I was just like, and he's just venting. By the way, there's people stacking up behind me trying to exit the plane. He goes, I'm so stressed on a day-to-day basis. Everything stresses me out. Everybody I work with stresses me out. I don't want to come home and feel that people are stressed out about where they work. He like, his blood pressure was like going through the roof. And I was like, okay, have a good day. And I was like, so grateful that he had landed the plane because right. He got really tense. And for everybody who's loved it, I mean, I think The Office has got more fans than anything. I just went to go talk to University of Michigan, and I had a line of people afterwards that were just like 100 people that just wanted to say what the show meant to them and right. How excited they were. Anyway, that always sticks in my brain of this guy just seeing the words Dunder Mifflin, his blood pressure went up because he doesn't like uncomfortable humor. He doesn't like cringe humor, and he must have seen a particularly uncomfortable episode where people were frustrated.
Right. Well, I mean, one of the things that I've always said was that it has a subversive quality that I think appeals potentially to younger people. I had a conversation with my parents, very similar to your pilot story, where they were talking about their friends who couldn't, who didn't like it. It's just too mean. And Michael Scott is just too mean. And here was my answer. My answer was, you know, what's the actual number one show in television at that time? It was, you know, through all the demographic, however old you are, was CSI. This is true. Uh-huh. I said, so mom, this is what you should say to them, is it's way more comfortable for you to watch, which every episode opened with, a half-naked, dead woman or teenager lying in the desert than to hear somebody say something potentially a little uncomfortable or maybe hits a little too close.
Didn't think long and hard about that.
Right.
Yeah, challenge that. Yeah,
right.
That's amazing.
All right. That is it for now, guys. But that is just the tip of the iceberg with Jen. Just the tip. We didn't even get to the fact that she went on to run our show with Paul Lieberstein in season 5. So we will have a lot more to talk about with Jen in a future episode. In the meantime, thank you all for listening. And let's take a page out of Jen's book this week, all right? And try to laugh just a little bit more. I'll see you next week. The Office Deep Dive is hosted and executive produced by me, Brian Baumgartner, alongside our executive producer, Ling Lee. Our senior producer is Tessa Kramer. Our associate producer is Emily Carr. And our assistant editor is Diego Tapia. My main man in the booth is Alec Moore. Our theme song, Bubble and Squeak, performed by my great friend Creed Bratton, and the episode was mixed by Seth Olansky.